Welcome to the Cello Sherpa podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit, from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. Robert Spano has been the music director of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra since 2001, and he is music director designate for the Fort Worth Symphony, where he will officially start in the spring of 2022. He is also an incredibly accomplished pianist and composer. I've heard that back in his days at the Curtis Institute of Music, that if you needed someone to walk into your lesson and sight read the accompaniment to an entire concerto, you had to go find Robert because he could play anything. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Oh, it's great to be here with you, Joel.
As a child, you played the violin, flute, and piano, and by the age of 14, you conducted a work you composed with the local orchestra. This sounds like quite an unusual childhood. With that wealth of talent that you obviously had, what led you down the path to becoming a conductor?
Well, I think the music was kind of the family business. So playing the instruments and composing and all of that was not with a lot of self-reflection. It was just what was happening. And I loved that. In retrospect, I feel so lucky. My mother's a pianist, her mother's a pianist, her father's a pianist, my dad's a clarinetist, and my uncle's a trumpeter, and so on. It all was very natural. It was just part of the day. And my father was a flute maker. And so when I think I was 8 or 9, and he said, okay, now you're going to play the flute, which I loved. I loved playing the flute. But I really wanted to play the violin. So I added the violin. A year later, I was getting a lot of pressure to choose, to focus. Are you going to play the violin? Are you going to play the flute? Are you going to play the piano? And I didn't want to decide. Mm-hmm. I was really enjoying it all, and I didn't want to decide. And of course, when you're young, you don't know anything. So why do I have to focus? I don't have to focus.
Yeah.
When I had that chance to conduct when I was so young, I thought, oh, this is the ticket. So instead of focusing, I started studying more instruments. I started studying the French horn. I played a little oboe, a little clarinet, fooled around with the cello, but did play the viola pretty well at one point. So I even played bass for 1 year. So I was terrible, but I did it. I wanted to broaden my understanding in that way. And I just kind of catered my musical work after that, knowing that my intention was to conduct.
So basically it was in your DNA is what you're saying. Music was just coming through all of your being from the beginning.
I think it was all in the family.
When you went to school, how did you decide what to focus on? What was your goal getting into your first college?
Well, I went to Oberlin as a composition major.
Oh, okay.
And if there was a focus when I was a kid, it was composing. That was the thing I identified with before I started conducting.
Uh-huh.
And continued to identify with it and started my undergrad degree in composition. But that was the time when you kind of had to choose between serialism and John Cage.
And that's a tough choice.
So in my second year, I had the anti-serialist teacher. The first year I had an amanuensis of Schoenberg, who was a brilliant, brilliant man. He was actually a very powerful musical influence because of his sophistication. But then the next year, everything was too conservative for this teacher. So finally, I put 3 flutes in a bathroom and asked them to improvise, and I recorded it. And I took this in to him. And he said, now this is your best work to date. And I said, okay, that's it. I am not doing this. And I switched and I got a piano degree.
Wow.
Yeah. It just wasn't.
I had no idea. Well, let me back up for just a second. So you're 14, you wrote and conducted your own piece. Did you have a composition teacher when you were a teenager also?
Yeah, I did. Kalamazoo. He just died recently and he was a fantastic teacher. I think I was 13 or 14 when I started studying with him. And he was at Western Michigan University, which wasn't so far from Elkhart, where I grew up. And he was just an amazing influence on my life. Among other things, he had me listening to so much stuff. I was listening to Crumb and Berio and Stockhausen and Ligeti and Ludoslavski and just on and on. And that exposure to so much music was amazing to have.
Yeah. You've started the Atlanta School of Composers. Would you say that when you picked the composers that you were looking for our seasons, that your own voice as a composer influenced who you were interested in, or did you try and go for what you thought the audience would be most interested in?
Neither.
Okay. Good answer.
You know, we didn't set out to have the Atlanta School. It evolved over the first 4 or 5 years that I was here. Uh-huh. And what we did do when I started was say, we don't need a composer in residence. I know all these composers. That's just not a resource we need. Instead, let's develop ongoing relationships with a few, and let's focus on Americans of my age, essentially. I could see that nobody else was doing that at that time. There were a lot of new music initiatives going on in the country by various orchestras or institutions, but none of them were really focusing the way Slatkin did in St. Louis. If you remember,
yes,
he just brought American composers all the time. And he was kind of my model. I wanted to fulfill that role that I could see was missing in the country. And so we did that. And then after a certain number of years, I think it was 4, maybe it was 5, I had to speak at a board retreat to kick it off. So I was supposed to say something inspiring or interesting at least. And I had no idea what I was going to talk about. I'm walking to the Art Center and I'm drinking my coffee and I'm thinking, what am I going to say? How can I get this thing off to a good start? And for whatever reason, I started thinking about the composers we've been working with and I realized, wait a minute, these people have, they don't sound like each other, but they have something in common. There's a real observable shift in American music of composers of this generation from their teachers and how they're putting music together. And I realized, okay, what are the common elements? They use tonality, they use tunes, and they're all influenced by world music or popular music or both. And even though they sound so different, that's a common ground they have. And I got all excited. Oh, we're witnessing this moment in American music that's discernible, like historically the Empfindsamkeit or Sturm und Drang or the Les Six in Paris or the Five in Russia. This is a, wow, this is happening. So that's what I ended up talking about. And then we realized, hey, we're doing this in Atlanta. We're commissioning them, recording them. Let's own them. And that's when we came up with the title Atlanta School.
Why did you never put yourself into that pool? Too busy?
Well, partially, yeah. Actually, I didn't write much music when I got here until the last 6-7 years. And the stuff I've been working on is all small scale, piano, piano and voice, chamber music. I haven't been hearing in my own head or wanting to write for orchestra right now. I wrote a lot of orchestral music as a kid, and I don't want it heard. I maybe should burn it at some point.
Don't do that.
But it's just not where my head is now.
Yeah.
And as I've started to compose again in these last 6-7 years, I have been playing for events for the symphony, for the board, for small audiences, and that's been great. I've really enjoyed that.
Yeah. So let's just go backwards for a second here, just to clarify. So at Oberlin, you went there as a composition major. Did you graduate as a piano major?
I did.
Or did you? Okay. And then what was your path after that that's led you to become music director of the Atlanta Symphony?
Well, actually at Oberlin, I entered into a conducting program. Oberlin has a few master's degrees that they roll in with an undergraduate degree. And one of them was conducting. And I really wanted to study with that teacher. And he was going to retire. So I did the first year of that program with him. And he was incredibly generous. He said, you're not going to screw up my retirement, but I will give you a lot of attention this year. And he did. And it was amazing. It was fantastic. It was the kind of training where he'd say, okay, now play Debussy, meaning improvise in the style of, play Mozart, play Mahler. Or he'd put Mahler 2 on the piano and say, play. Or he'd give me 3 voice, atonal, dictation, or, you know, just all the kinds of old school rigorous training that is all too rare these days in the world. And he was just amazing. But then he retired and the school had not replaced him. So who was going to run the orchestra program? They hired me while they did a search. So I was the de facto head of the orchestral program for my last year, which was wild.
That's trial by fire right there, isn't it?
It was amazing. I mean, I had a few concerts of my own as well. And then I was prepping for these guests who were coming in to get his job. So that was also amazing training. And then I went to Curtis to study with Max Rudolph, who was the great pedagogue of conducting. And his aesthetic or his school or his teaching were so much in line with what I'd been taught and what I'd been doing that it was great. I mean, everything made sense to me, and he was very demanding. It was very rigorous. And he was one of those people who intuitively understood people very quickly. So there were five of us studying with him, and he treated us all quite differently. We were usually with him in the group. We didn't see him individually much at all. But it was noticeable that he had figured out the psychology of each of us at some level to know how to motivate or criticize or reassure or whatever was happening. In retrospect, it was really impressive, that perspicacity. He was incredible. And also just the basic stuff was great. But I'd been at Oberlin for 5 years. And the reason I had that fifth year was I had that job, because otherwise I couldn't have afforded it. Curtis was free, but I still had to work 4 or 5 jobs to pay the rent.
Right.
So I was determined to get a job as soon as I could. So I was only at Curtis 1 year. Then I got a job at Bowling Green State University. And I taught there for 4 years. And that's actually where I met Jennifer Higdon.
Oh, okay.
She was doing her undergrad in flute there. And she wanted to take my graduate seminar in conducting. And so I let her in because she was clearly so brilliant. She swears, I don't know if it's true, she swears it's true that she got a lot of offers for grad school to study composition. And when I learned about that, she says, I locked her in my office and told her I wouldn't let her out until she promised me she would go to Curtis. I don't know, maybe I did that, I don't remember. But she did go to Curtis,
yeah,
which is great, and teaches there now.
Right.
So that all worked out very well. And then I had the chance to go back to teach at Oberlin after those 4 years at Bowling Green. The Bowling Green years were especially potent for me because there was an opera director there who was a giant. It was a kind of retirement job for him in a way. He had worked in the profession for a long time, first as a singer and also on Broadway. It wasn't just opera. He had been on the I Love Lucy show and the Ed Sullivan show. So this, he was a performer first. His name was Roy Lazarus.
Oh, okay.
He was one of the first ones to sing Standing on the Corner Watching All the Girls Go By in that show on Broadway.
Uh-huh.
He had this rich history. Stravinsky was one of his fans at Santa Fe. He had run, I think, the Kansas City Opera professionally, but then he also taught at Oberlin, Juilliard, and IU at various times. So a lot of singers had worked with him over decades. And so here he is at Bowling Green, and I'm doing all my first operas with him. We did 2 a year. That was just unbelievably great. To get to work with someone that savvy and experienced and insightful and knowledgeable, doing your first Magic Flute or Marriage of Figaro, Giovanni, all the things we did, first Puccini operas for me. So when I was hired back at Oberlin, I did not run the orchestra program. I'd done that as a student. But when I was hired back, I was hired to do the operas and the new music ensemble.
Oh, perfect.
It was great. I loved it. And again, I had another great colleague in the opera department. She and I got along great. And it was a whole different education from the one I'd gotten from Roy Lazarus, because she, Judith Lang, had this tremendous academic education. So every time we would set out to do an opera, she would research it so thoroughly. It was just unbelievable. And we'd be reading the novels that inspired it and researching the librettist as well as the composer. I mean, it was just this wonderful deep dive into the, I guess you could say, musicological aspect, for lack of a better term. And that was great. And after 1 year at Oberlin teaching, I had the chance to go to the BSO, Boston Symphony Orchestra, to be Seiji Ozawa's assistant. And I did that for 3 years. And he was unbelievable. He was such a huge influence on me. My predecessor had said, now, this is a job. He's not your teacher. You can't expect him to this, that, or the other thing. And I believed that for about a week. And then I thought, oh, this isn't going to work. So I just started to bother him all the time. And he was so great. You know, he was so responsive and so generous. And I talked about a lot of things with him. I was also his orchestra. So if he was doing an opera or working with a soloist, I would play for him.
Yeah.
And that was fantastic. And then I remained Tanglewood affiliated, I think, for 15 years after that in one capacity or another. I taught conducting there. I ran the New Music Festival for a couple of years. I went at other times for kind of grab bag of things that needed to be taken care of. That was an immense gift. 15 years at Tanglewood was an immense gift.
Yeah, I bet.
And during the 3 years at the BSO, I got a number of, so that's the first professional orchestra I ever conducted.
Wow, that's quite a place to start.
That's crazy.
Yes.
It's just crazy. I think the month before that first, I had a subscription concert. I think it was about a month before I just started vomiting.
Oh, jeez.
Just absolute terror. And the orchestra was so great to me. I loved them. They were so supportive. I remember the first rehearsal, we're doing Sibelius I, and we get to the end of the finale where the big tune comes, the violins, and they all started standing up. It was very sweet.
Yeah, I guess that would be a real turning point in your career, though, to have that opportunity to sort of push you down the conductor, music director role.
Yeah, and while I was there, I went to Chicago and Toronto and Philadelphia for the first time. So all of that was a very intense period. And when I left Boston, I was homeless for 3 years. I was guest conducting so much, I lived in a hotel for that first year. Finally, I got an apartment in Cleveland, and I was there when I was working at Oberlin, because I still went back to Oberlin part-time. I would do as much as I could, usually one, maybe two opera productions a year. And then I went to the Brooklyn Philharmonic at BAM. And unfortunately, that orchestra no longer exists. But when it was there, it was such an exciting place. BAM is such a great place. The Brooklyn Philharmonic had been founded by Siegfried Landau, but then Lucas Foss had done it for decades after that. And then my direct predecessor was Dennis Russell Davies. So the orchestra had a history and identity of doing things alternatively to the New York Philharmonic. I mean, we were David to that Goliath, in a sense. It was a wild ride. We were always coming up with some way to do things or some combination of things that was thrilling, insightful, enlightening. And the orchestra was great because at that time, the New York freelance scene was not like it is now. It was vibrant. So the players were terrific, even though we only got together 6 times a year. So that was the first orchestra I had. After I'd been doing Brooklyn, I really wanted an orchestra that was full-time. And I really wanted to put down roots. And I wanted to find out what happens if you get to live with an orchestra. Because one of my frustrations in Brooklyn was always, we got to do more. We got to do more. There's a ceiling on how much better we're going to get if we don't do more. And I was really hungry for that. And at the time, there were a number of American orchestras looking. And one of them was Atlanta. I had been here twice, I think, and I already was really impressed with the orchestra, and I wanted this job. So I was sure it was not going to happen. I'm thinking, if that's the one I want, I just don't get your hopes up.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense.
So when I got the call, I was actually in Wales working at Welsh National Opera, and I was just thrilled out of my mind. It was so exciting for me. And I got exactly what I wanted. I mean, we've lived together for 20 years, so it's this immense gift in my life. And I also got what I wanted in the sense of we can do a lot really fast because we've worked together long enough. And to me, that's amazing. And we can go deep really fast. I mean, we can start taking care of stuff because we have a kind of shared agenda and values and what we're listening for and what's important. And I feel like I understand the orchestra and I feel like the orchestra understands me. And that's what I had wanted, the sort of grand string quartet experience.
Yeah, you definitely got that. So then how do you view your role as a conductor? Are you the sorcerer that creates the magic of the music, or Are you the catalyst that pulls the reactions from the orchestra? I mean, what would you view your role as?
I think it's my job to, this is not a complete answer, is to elicit the maximum from everybody's talent and creativity. Now, obviously, there's a line to be walked there, because if you start showing your talent and creativity and not playing with anybody else in the section, we're going to have a problem.
That's true.
And if I don't kind of head us in a certain direction, we're also going to have a problem. But I love the balance beam of playing chamber music, in the sense of, for me, it's the principles fulfill a certain role. Because if David Kusharan is on to something, I'm interested. I want to know what he's hearing or what he's interested in. Or if Christina does something in a solo that I never would have thought of, I want that. I mean, that for me, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Listen to that. I couldn't have thought of that. I like being inspired too. And so I love what happens when people are investing musically in the process. And I try to walk that line of out of many, one. Mm-hmm. I am an American after all. So I want that. And I try to walk that line so that everybody's invested. I know we talk about the music business all the time, but it's not a business.
That's true. It's a profession.
And an art.
That's right. Well, so then it seems to me that you don't really fit the stereotype of what we've thought of as the maestro that's evolved for centuries, that you've departed from that, especially in this collaborative nature that you talk about. And I think in the way that you interact with the orchestra, how do you think you fit that stereotype? Or have you tried to be different than that stereotype?
Oh, so in a sense, you're talking about the Toscanini stereotype.
I think so, yeah. That would be fair.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's around. Yeah, I know what you mean. I guess for me, the models were always Metropolis as opposed to, or Bruno Walter as opposed to Klemperer. Not that I don't admire Klemperer, but there's something about the mode of working. Those are the two that leap to mind right away. And historically, too, conducting evolved out of a need for people to play together, not a need for someone to tell everyone else what to do. So I think that the fact that the baton is a modified bow, and we can still go back to situations where one is conducting from the harpsichord or from the violin, that's what Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg is doing in California and Josh Bell is doing in London. And I think there's still tremendous beauty in when we can shrink down to that size where we can hear better. And so much of conducting has to do with helping the challenges of not being able to hear each other, because ideally everything should be working because you can hear each other. And that's just never the case. I mean, even the best stages in the world, over here, you're not going to hear what's going on over there, and this one's not going to work. And so there's a, or also just sheer numbers, because now you're dealing with greater dimensions of space. What we understand as conducting is really a 19th century phenomenon. If you think of that early Berlioz treatise, it's so interesting, because he's one of the first ones to delineate, okay, this is a beat pattern. This is a four pattern. This is a two pattern. This is a three pattern. He starts to codify. And certainly if you're using a bow and you're working with your own band, that codification wasn't happening.
Right. That makes sense.
But Berlioz couldn't play an instrument decent.
Uh-huh.
I mean, maybe he was a good guitarist. I'm not sure.
We're going to pause for a short break. To all of you other cello Sherpas out there nurturing future generations of cellists or any other instrument, we have a new feature just for you. Many of the topics we will cover here on the Cello Sherpa podcast are worthy of further discussion, so we wanted to let you know about teaching points we will be posting on our website after each podcast. We develop these materials with you and your students in mind. Feel free to copy them, hand them out, and use them as assignments to be completed after listening to our podcast, or just tools for raising the level of professionalism in your studio classes, rep classes, orchestra, or band programs. Please visit our website for more information and click on the Teaching Points tab. And as always, give us some feedback on what you'd like to learn more about on the Cello Sherpa podcast. And while you're at it, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us on whatever platform you get your podcast from. This helps our rankings and makes it easier for others to find us.
So what do you enjoy most about the role of the music director?
It's the concerts.
The concerts. I would say that's what I enjoy most also.
Yeah. I mean, that's the rest is some of it's enjoyable and some of it's not.
What's not?
Oh, I hate making personnel decisions.
Okay. I knew you were going to say that, actually.
How did you know?
I've been through enough of those decisions with you to see that it's a challenge for you. It doesn't come naturally to you.
No, that's someone's life.
Yeah.
And I just feel the weight of that responsibility. I think our committee system is really great. And the thing that's made it possible for me is that system works most of the time. Twice, maybe I've had to call the committee into question and say, can you reconsider this? Because I could tell the system didn't do its job, but that's very rare. I feel grateful that it's there, that it was implemented.
Yeah.
It's just hard to wrestle with those decisions.
Well, speaking of that decision, I think it would be really helpful to our audience to know what you look for when you make that decision.
In a new musician?
Yes, in a new hire.
Ah, okay. We're looking for talent. In truth, it is that. I mean, and what is that? Who said about I can't define it, but I know it when I see it.
You know? I don't know who said that. I might have to cut that out.
In the Cincinnati court cases around something.
Can you give me a different example? One that's PG-10.
When we hear talent,
yeah,
we know it. You know when you're hearing someone talented at what they do. And also it's a particular talent because it is possible for someone to come in and play a particular instrument so brilliantly that you're overwhelmed, dazzled, and they don't know how to play with an orchestra. It's that combination of expertise and musicality and proficiency and virtuosity with sensibility, with that gift of knowing how to listen and how to interact and how to contribute, how to step back, step forward. It's a particular talent. So I think that's what we're always looking for.
Yeah, and it's hard to evaluate whether people can play well with other people when they're sitting on stage by themselves. That is one of the challenges of how we audition, which I know has led to many trial weeks in the time that you've been here.
And I'm so grateful we've done those because we learn so much.
I think they're extremely helpful in making decisions about whether people can fit into a section. Mm-hmm. Because it becomes very obvious when you have somebody that you can hear play and play at a high level. If they come play for a week, it's usually pretty clear within a few hours whether their antenna's up, whether they're paying attention, whether they're playing with other people and trying to become of one voice, or whether they're trying to show off and assert what they got.
Right.
Which isn't really what we're looking for, is it?
Or oblivious.
that too. So what advice would you have for young musicians who hear a calling to become a conductor? And I mean that specifically with how do you balance your study between instrument and conducting? And I think we've talked a lot already about that, but maybe a little bit more in depth about how you manage to balance so many things at the same time.
I'm just going to keep giving you stuff you have to cut. Don't do it! I think for me, the most important thing for somebody who aspires to be a conductor is to study everything other than conducting as much as possible. Get real proficiency on an instrument. Study the repertoire from a perspective of compositional analysis and theoretical understanding, as well as historical context. Study languages. Listen to a broad spectrum of the repertoire. Attend concerts and rehearsals if you can, even better. Max Rudolph used to say the best way to learn how to conduct is to conduct. The second best way is to observe. And then a teacher might be able to help too. So many young or aspiring conductors I know go to rehearsals and stare at their scores. And they should be staring at their scores at home. They're not paying attention to the dynamics of the room. And you can learn just as much from something that's not good or not working as you can from something that's paradigmatic. So if you're watching a rehearsal and you can see something's not working, you got to try and figure out why. That's one of the great teachers. When I was watching all those rehearsals and concerts in Boston for 3 years, for me, it was that opportunity to see what was going on, what worked with the orchestra, what didn't, why, what was missing, what wasn't, what was great. If something worked and I didn't understand why, that was also effective. Why? How did that work? That process of really observing, I think, is critical, because in the end, conducting is so personal. But I don't think that's the part that one has to develop. There's a great line of Cocteau: an original artist cannot help but be original. Therefore, he need only copy. So if you're working on basics, fundamentals, work on ear training, work on solfege, work on score playing at the keyboard, even if you're a violinist, that stuff is foundational, because this is not the hard part of conducting. It's the musical and interpersonal aspects of conducting that are difficult. This is, you can learn in a year if you bother. Mm-hmm. I mean, and play chamber music. I left that up. Play chamber music, for heaven's sake. Because I'm teaching at Aspen, I become acutely aware of these deficiencies in the people who want to conduct. And of course, if you get the bug, like I did at a young age, it's maniacal. I mean, if you've got the, no one would become a conductor unless they were foolish enough to become a conductor, because it's too difficult, too competitive, and all of that. But if you get the bug, you want to get on there. You want to do the conducting, and you think you know everything. Otherwise, you wouldn't have the bug.
It's hard to stand in front of 88 musicians that have been playing their entire career if you don't have some sort of ego, I would imagine, and tell them how to do everything, right?
So it's for me, it's that broad, not only musical, although fundamentally musical, and cultural education that's so necessary. And it's lifelong. I have met many aspiring conductors who don't know quite what to do with their time because they don't get opportunities on the podium. And I try to alert them to the fact that there's not enough time to do everything you need to do before you get on the podium.
So have you seen young conductors that have stopped pursuing one instrument at their highest level because they just want to focus on conducting?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. And you would say that that's not the best approach, in your opinion?
I think it's a big mistake.
Okay, that makes sense.
I think it's terrible. Even if you're not going to be great, keep practicing.
Yeah. Well, as a music major, you know we're all required to take a conducting class with instrumentalists. And I was wondering if you think it's important to learn conducting, or you think they just make us do that so that musicians will be nicer to the conductor after they experience how difficult it is.
I don't know. Did you benefit from it?
I enjoyed it, actually. It was,
yeah.
I think I benefited just to understand what it means to be up there and to try and shape something outside of your own voice. And of course, you also get ridiculed by all your colleagues because we all have to play in each other's orchestra.
Right. I think the other value is actually a connection to music in a kinetic way that is not specific to an instrument, in terms of developing a stronger rhythmic sense, to move in a musical way and to move rhythmically, kind of in the spirit of the whole Dalcroze Eurythmics movement.
At Cleveland, right?
Yeah. I think there's something to that physical connection, because ultimately, as a musician, however much we use our brains and think about things and make decisions and all of that, the intellect, the brain, is too slow. And when you're playing a Paganini concerto, that brain is not as fast. Music requires then also the motor intelligence that we all know we have by walking and riding bikes. And music requires that motor intelligence as well. And that we learn it on an instrument. But you need it in conducting too. I suspect that because conducting physically is so much easier than any instrument, it is an opportunity to physically connect in a way that activates that motor intelligence. And then, of course, you need to be emotionally invested. So it's really, to me, a very clear discipline of Platonic idealism about how to be a real human being, which is that synthesis of our multiple intelligences. And I think that's a reason that music was in the Platonic Academy. The quadrivium was arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music. And it seems to me that's why it was there, because, and that's why music education can't be about appreciation. It's got to be about doing.
Yeah.
Our kids have to play or sing music. They just, there's no other way to connect. And that's why it's so valuable. And we know, I mean, now we always knew, but now we've proven what we knew, because all the brain mapping and stuff, all the studies show how unbelievably powerful music is for hemispheric connection in the brain. It's almost irreplaceable.
Yeah. And speaking of the power of music and reflecting on this last year, how do you see the profession changing as a result of COVID?
Well, I guess we'll all see. There's one thing I find very encouraging, which is the number of people, especially music lovers, non-musicians per se, and listeners, who are starved for live music, who say how much they appreciate all the efforts made on the internet and how much they're grateful that we were doing virtual concerts and that we can access music in that way, but that it is not the same. And so my hope is, if my anecdotal experience of these people recognizing the nourishment we've been lacking will help when we actually get back to playing live concerts, to recognize their value, their intrinsic value, which is unlike any other experience.
Yeah. And also focusing in this past year, really thinking about purposeful and meaningful change with regards to diversity, equity, inclusion as part of this. What do you see as your role in these efforts moving forward?
I think it's the same role I've played all my life. I feel that I inherited the work of Robert Shaw in Atlanta, who was as much a part of the civil rights movement at that time as any other civic leader in Atlanta. And I've always felt his shadow over me here in a really positive way, because I didn't know him. Mm-hmm. And because I don't know him, he can be this ideal for me, because I'm not threatened, or, you know, I'm not worried about if I had worked with him or something, it might be not so easy. But because I didn't, he's a model for me. He's an example of what one should be doing as a music director of any orchestra. And I think the biggest issue confronting us in terms of furthering that work is education. Because if you don't have, and you know that goes for everybody, if you don't have access to music, and if you don't connect with music, you're not going to have the chance to become good enough to be part of the profession. And if we want the profession to look more like the society in which we live, we have to address this larger social issue. And I'm hoping we're going to find a way, and I want to be part of that, to get music back in the public schools, because I think that that's, yes, it's important for music, but for me, it's important for our society. It's important for the good of our society, because people who study music benefit, and everything else they learn and do is benefited by the study of music.
Absolutely.
And that for me is the ticket. Is education, because we can say we want to hire X number of people of whatever description to fill X number of positions. And unless we have the talent that's been cultivated, the talent's there, of course, but talent is worthless unless it's cultivated.
Right.
Then we can't fill that position in the way we might like to. And that, to me, is the big challenge. That's why I'm very, I don't know if proud's the right word, I'm very grateful that we've had the TDP all this time. Because to me, that's the way. It's not big enough. It's not grand enough. It's not national enough.
Right.
But it's the right attitude.
Yeah.
And it was, we were doing the right thing to the extent that we could do it in that way. To me, that's the way of the future.
Yeah. And I think it also goes back to what you said earlier about, it's one thing to observe. It's another thing to do. So if you put instruments in, I mean, we were in this fight 10 years ago for the elementary music programs here.
I remember.
If you put these instruments in children's hands and let them feel the vibration and the experience of learning how to do this, it's much different than putting them on a bus and bringing them to hear a concert.
Absolutely.
It It's just completely different. It's the same thing if you watch sports. You don't understand what it means to swing a tennis racket until you get out there and try and do it.
Absolutely.
And understand what the force is and what it takes. And when you do it a little bit, then you could view it in a different light when you understand it. And I think that's what we need to be thinking of more when it comes to cultivating an audience and cultivating more musicians and cultivating all of us and being human beings and sharing in this joy that's part of our education, part of something that makes us all human.
Yeah. So. And do you remember those studies that came out? I can't remember when now. The numbers of people who were subscribers to concerts who had studied music as a child was overwhelming.
Yeah, I believe it.
Even if they didn't continue.
Yep. So is there any other advice you'd like to offer to our audience that we've missed?
If I had to come up with something worth saying today, I would focus on trusting that some things take time and there's no substitute. So when you come up against something that seems insurmountable, trust that everything can change through effort applied through time. Persistence. Calvin Coolidge said, nothing in the world can take place of persistence. Talent will not, undeveloped talent is legion. Education will not, the streets are full of educated derelicts. Genius will not, unrecognized genius is legion. Persistence alone is omnipotent. And there's something about finding in oneself, because it's an act of faith, it's a trust. If I continue to put my effort into this aim, this goal, things will change over time. Just think of what a seed has to go through to become a tree, and the time it takes, and the energy that takes, the transformation that takes. And we don't even recognize the seed in the tree. And yet the seed contained the memory, so to speak, of the future of the tree in it as a seed. I guess all I'm saying is don't give up.
Yeah.
Because there are things that there's no substitute for effort over time. And knowing what you want and going for it and not backing down. Don't make what you want something that's out of your control. Because there are things that you may want, but you're not in charge. So if you decide, well, I have to play in the Atlanta Symphony someday, are you really going to be disappointed because you're in the Minneapolis Orchestra? Aims have to be carefully stated for oneself, I think. And it's that confidence in the sense of trusting what the future is going to bring because of what you're investing. There's payoff from investment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this career takes a lot of investment. It's continual, too, as you said, a life learner to be in this profession.
And for most people, a lot of patience.
Yeah, a lot. That is very true. So are you anywhere on social media where people can find you?
I think there's a Facebook page.
Okay.
And there's also a website. I think I'm Robert Spano Music. I don't know if it's com or org. And neither one is, I don't think they're all that interesting, but there's basic information there, calendars of concerts or stuff like that.
Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. You can find more information about Robert Spano on his Facebook fan page, at Maestro Robert Spano, and his website, www.robertspanomusic.com. Be sure and catch our next episode where we interview Michael Kurth, who's a fantastic composer and has been a member of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra bass section since 1994. We're here to serve you, so if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like us to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com, or tweet them at us, @thecellosherpa. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Be sure and subscribe to the Cello Sherpa podcast so you'll be notified when our next episode posts. Today's episode was produced, recorded, and mostly edited by Joel Dallow with some much-needed assistance from Mark DiClaudio at 3Wire Creative. You can find more information about them at 3, and that's the number 3, wirecreative.com.